This mic is going to be useless, I think. It's so far down. So I'll use my outside voice. It's such a joy and a privilege to be with you all today. I want to thank Reverend Bancroft in particular, as the minister of this house, for the invitation. It's Madeline, who just walked out, especially for being patient with me, as I'm hard to reach sometimes. And this committee for this invitation. I already carry a name, Paul Robeson, that places a great weight and responsibility on me to stand now in this pulpit and to come and deliver a word in the legacy of Theodore Parker just adds to that weight. And so hopefully my shoulders can hold it up and I will not collapse under that over the years. It's always a blessing and joy to have my family with me, my wife, Reverend Kirsten, who's a Protestant chaplain at Brown University, as well as all three of my children, the oldest, Cheyenne, the middle one, Ayana, and the little dude reading his iPad, Jackson, William Jackson. Amen. It is a special honor to be here for this second annual Theodore Parker Lecture. And the subject that I have selected is under the title, Turning the World Upside Down, Lasting Strategies for Criminal Justice Reform. I am, of course, a pastor and a preacher invested in the Christian tradition. And so I have considered all of these subjects when we look at the situation of mass incarceration through that lens, as someone who has been grounded in liberation theology and black theology and the theologies of the third world, and understanding being raised at the Riverside Church under the Reverend Dr. William Sloan Coffin and then Dr. James A. Forbes, there has always been an understanding that there is no disconnection between social witness and faith in God, and that if you claim faith in God, you must be ready to speak that witness into the world prophetically so that we can see the changes that need to happen. And so I lift up to you as a grounding passage, this passage from the 17th chapter of the Acts of the Apostles that starts this way, and there is a key verse in here. After Paul and Silas had passed through Amphipolis and Apollonia, they came to Thessalonica, where there was a synagogue of the Jews. And Paul went in, as was his custom, and on three Sabbath days argued with them from the scriptures, explaining and proving that it was necessary for the Messiah to rise from the dead, and saying, "This is the Messiah, Jesus, whom I am proclaiming to you." Some of them were persuaded and joined Paul and Silas, as did a great many of the devout Greeks and not a few of the leading women. But the Jews became jealous, and with the help of some ruffians in the marketplaces, they formed a mob and set the city in an uproar. While they were searching for Paul and Silas to bring them out to the assembly, they attacked Jason's house. When they could not find them, they dragged Jason and some believers before the city authorities, shouting, "These people who have been turning the world upside down have come here also, and Jason has entertained them as guests. They are all acting contrary to the decrees of the emperor, saying that there is another king named Jesus." These people who have been turning the world upside down have come here also. It's quite a statement to accuse some people or some group of people or some movement of turning the world upside down. And it actually says more about your broken view of the world and the state of the world as it is, that you would see those who are seeking to be and to bring change as turning the world upside down. And the premise that I want to submit to you all today that grounds my consideration of this subject is that the world as we know it is upside down, but it is largely in denial about that reality. for these men to say that these disciples, these to classify them as people who've been turning the world upside down, was really one of the deepest analyses of the threat that the message of Jesus Christ posed in the social and political world of Israel under the God of the Roman Empire 2,000 years ago. I constantly remind folks in Bible study that 2,000 years later, it is difficult to understand that back in those days, there was no conversation about a separation between church and state. There was no understanding of trying to distinguish and dichotomize religion and politics, faith and politics. The religious was political, and the political was religious, because it was understood that to declare that the kingdom of God is at hand was not only a threat to those who worshiped some other god, but to remember, of course, that the Roman emperor wanted you worshiping him. And so to declare that the kingdom of God was at hand was a threat to not just the religious order, but the political order. And what we must understand from that time, even as we have sorted through things in our own American way, is that there is and can be no disconnection between our faith and our faith values and the values that we draw from our faith and from our theological understandings and the politics, which is simply the way in which we live these out in the world. I am one who will make the claim that everything is theological, even if we don't want to claim it as such. Every political position that we hold, every ethical premise that we put out there is theological, because however we understand the transcendent power, our values and our politics says something directly about how we believe we ought to relate to that which transcends us all. And so to say that those people who have been turning the world upside down have come here also is a recognition that the message they were bringing and the movement they represented threatened the fundamental way in which the world was viewed and meant to shift it. And so I asked one of your members for a pair of scissors when I came in, because there's an important visual that I need to suggest to you. Now, if I were to stand here and tell you that these two cups are ready for you to drink out of, you would look at me as if I was a madman. And you would look at me as if I was a madman for two very obvious reasons. One, and first of all, the cups are upside down. You cannot drink out of upside down cups. But that's just the first of the problems, because the second of the problems is that I have punctured holes in the bottom of these cups. And if you were to try to pour anything in these cups that you would then try to drink, it would all leak out of the bottom. And so if you were to tell me, you can't possibly mean that I'm to drink out of that cup because that cup is upside down and has a hole in it. And I were to swear to you, no, this cup is ready to drink out of just the way that it is. And you would say to me, no, the cup is upside down. I can't possibly drink out of that. And I would say, you fine. The cup is now right side up. But no, the cup has a hole in it. No, it's fine. Just pour the water in there. It'll be fine. No, it's going to go through the bottom of the cup. I submit to you, my friends, that the way in which we look at the whole subject of criminal justice in this country right now is as if I were to stand here and tell you to drink out of a cup that was upside down with a hole in it, and to swear to you that there was nothing wrong with these tools and that they were ready to be used. The world as we know it is upside down, but is in denial about that reality. And so when we consider lasting strategies for criminal justice reform, we must understand that our work is the work of turning the world upside down so that it might one day be right side up. Turning the world upside down so that it might one day be right side up. It can seem like a contradiction at first, but it is in fact the paradox that proves the point. If we understand the simple fact that no matter what anyone else tries to tell you, you cannot drink water out of a cup that is upside down with a hole in it. And so the first work is, of course, turning that which is upside down, upside down. And then we can start dealing with the hole in it. And so I want to suggest to you three simple takeaways that you must consider when we think about lasting strategies for criminal justice reform. The first of them is that we are charged in this era, 2015, with exorcising the demon of white supremacy from every institution and every agency that participates in the work of criminal justice in this nation. There is a powerful, yes, we must exorcise the demon of white supremacy. And first of all, that means recognizing white supremacy through an explicit theological lens before we seek to translate it into any other lens for the purposes of any other conversation. We must first recognize that white supremacy represents a demonic presence in our midst. There was a powerful story in the Christian scriptures, the story of the Gerasene demoniac. And it's a story that goes that Jesus comes out of a boat and has this encounter with a man who had been possessed by demons for all of these years and was living in the tombs and was constantly bruising himself with stones. And depending on the version of the story you're reading, had been shackled before, but had broken those shackles. It's a most terrifying image that we are given. But one of the important verses in that passage of scripture, depending on where you're looking at it, is the reference that it says that the demons had the man. The demons had the man. And the reason why that line is so important is because it's the opposite of saying that the man had demons. The man had demons, which enables us and opens the door to us to demonize people who are acting out of sorts and crazy. But to suggest instead that the demons had the man reminds us that it's not about the people, but it's about the darkness that can consume them. And I use the term darkness not to refer to color, because of course white supremacy leverages skin color to wicked ends, but instead to recognize what the Johannine scriptures call as the absence of light. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness does not overcome it. What we are talking about when we talk about white supremacy as a demonic presence is about the evil that this darkness represents and about how this evil can possess us and steal our right mind. Some of these are just simple cliches that you've heard, that no one is born racist. No one is born invested in white supremacy. We are taught that. Cultures teach that. Institutions speak in the way that they operate in discriminatory ways from the top to the bottom, in ways subtle and in ways more explicit. And they teach us that. And for many decades now, men and women of faith have been trying to sort out how the legacy of white supremacy, which has pervaded each and every possible institution and circle of thought that one can imagine in this country, can be reconciled with the best of what every faith tradition, but most certainly the Christian tradition, calls us to, everything that Theodore Parker embodied and Martin Luther King in quoting him so many years later. Dr. James Hal Cone declared years ago the simple truth that racism is evil. Kill it. Racism is evil. Kill it. doesn't mean racist people are evil, but racism is evil. Kill it. White supremacy is what racism looks like when it is systematized. White supremacy is what racism looks like when it's institutionalized. White supremacy is what racism looks like when it is normalized. We come to expect it. We cannot ever lose sight how powerful a thing it is to normalize something, because to make something normal is to make us simply immune to the offensive nature of it. We begin to expect it. White supremacy is what racism looks like in sophisticated form. It is what racism looks like when it pervades each and every sector of a people's culture and traditions and its ways of life. White supremacy is at base an idea. It's just an idea. And it is based on a theological premise that white people were designed by God out of a separate and more superior pile of dust than the dust that was used to make the rest of us. That's the simple premise, that we are made from dust of the earth, but the premise of white supremacy is that there was a special dust that God made white people out of and used the other dust to make all of the rest of us out of it. There was a time, Reverend Bancroft, when this was a new idea. There was a time when the Enlightenment was still a work in progress. It was a working project, and it could have been corrected as it began to design this idea in explicit terms that there was a ladder of intellectual and civilizational superiority. But that moment has long since passed. We have inherited white supremacy. We have inherited this demon in our midst, and the demon has the man, and the man is embodied in our courts, in our law enforcement agencies, in our so-called correctional practices, and in our body politic that regulates them all. This nation is possessed by the demon of white supremacy. And that is what we have to face. And we have to recognize theologically that if we're really going to get to the bottom of this, if we're really going to correct things, we cannot stop with the surface level. We cannot stop with state governments trying to save money and so looking to close down a few facilities and open up a few more drug rehabs. That does not get us to the heart of it all. If we're going to have lasting criminal justice reform in this country, we must do the much more difficult work of facing the fact that there is a demon in our midst that must be exorcised. Modern media has commented on the fact that under Pope Francis, in addition to the social gospel that he has lifted back up, he has reinvigorated the practice and the study of exorcising demons. And so, of course, it draws my attention back to that when we think about the ritualistic practices and then back up and think about them from an abstract perspective of what must go on to exorcise demons from our midst. First of all, you have to face them. And you have to accept the fact that that's what's going on. Second of all, you have to call them out by name. You have to call them out by name. And then you have to give them their appropriate place to go. And that is not amongst our systems. Jesus allowed those demons, their name was Legion, to go off into the swine herd and off into the lake. Right now, they are all within our systems of criminal justice. And so I need all of us to recognize that the conversation that we're having right now in the American body politic, while it seems to be groundbreaking and it seems to be on the vanguard, because for the first time in years, politicians and elected officials and people running for president are talking about criminal justice reform, and a few of them are even daring to use the phrase mass incarceration. It's just the surface level. There is a deeper theological understanding that we must have. And it was most acutely emphasized for me in a way that I never could have captured otherwise, to see how much of a battle we had to have over bringing down the Confederate flag from the Capitol building in Charlestown, South Carolina, not in 1867, not in 1870, not in 1890 or 1900 or 1960, but in 2015. A governor had to dance and dawdle around and figure out where to stand on the politically charged issue of whether or not we take down this flag, because for some people this flag represented their heritage, and for other people we understood this flag represented slavery. Slavery is a fact. And it's a fact that the Civil War happened because of slavery. And the facts are there in every historical document from every state that seceded from the Union that said they were doing it to protect their right to keep people who look like me in bondage. It's a fact. And yet there were those who would stand, this is about my Southern heritage. This is about my great-great-grandfather who died fighting for the Confederacy. And that we have to face the reality that those who died fighting to protect the right to keep slavery in place died for the wrong cause. The namesake of this church understood that 150 years ago. Why has it taken us so long? And we still haven't come to grips with it. It's because of white supremacy. Only white supremacy allows you to think that a war that was about nothing else but the right to keep black people in chains was about something else other than that. That's what white supremacy does. It creates a system of thought that stands on its own, and so we do everything to protect it and to beat around the bush and to avoid facing the reality. The demons have that man. Their name is Legion. And we must confront them and cast them out. White supremacy is alive and well in 2015. And we will not get down to the bottom of what we're trying to fix with criminal injustice until we face that fact. And here's what I will say to all of you. Most black people and people of color have recognized the reality of white supremacy for years. You know what's most important? That all of you recognize the reality of white supremacy. Because there are conversations that must be had that I cannot have with my white brothers and sisters because they don't want to hear it from people like me. They pigeonhole me as an angry black man. They need to hear angry white people calling them out on white supremacy. Turning the world upside down is about recognizing the demon of white supremacy that has infected and pervaded every institution that has its hands in criminal justice and turn this world upside down. But people have become so used to it being upside down, they believe that it's right side up. And so now they will accuse those of us who come pointing out that there is a fundamental change that needs to be made, as if we are the ones who have come here to turn the world upside down. And so first of all, we must exorcise the demon of white supremacy from every institution, every agency that has anything to do with law enforcement and criminal justice in this country. But second of all, we must make the shift from a system that is focused on retribution and punishment to a system centered on restoration. From a system focused on retribution and punishment to a system centered on restoration. If you have not read it yet and you're interested in these subjects, I encourage you to pick up a book that is probably now 30-some years old called Changing Lenses by Howard Zeer, a Mennonite theologian who put a lot of this stuff on paper. Of course, a lot of this stuff is a viewpoint that's been going on in indigenous communities of color for many, many generations. But the history of America is that white people discover things that black people have been doing for a long time, write books about them, and then go out and sell them and talk about how they've discovered an idea. And now we call that Columbushing things. I Columbushed it. No, it's going on for a long time, and there were people there doing it before you got there and claimed to have discovered it. But the reality is that our criminal justice system as it is built on the premise of retribution and punishment. We have a retributive justice system that says if you go out and break into someone's house, breaking and entering, and scatter everything around that house, and take the valuable things from that house, and maybe threaten somebody you run into in that house, that the state is going to come in and exact retribution on you to send a message and to mete out punishment that says that if you go and you murder somebody in a community, the state is going to come in and exact retribution on behalf of that person and mete out punishment. Our system is built on retribution, on an eye for an eye. We have defined justice as taking an eye for an eye and getting back at people for what they do to us, and that is upside down, but we understand justice that way and have for so long that I would swear to you, if I invested in that ideology, that you could drink out of these cups in the shape they are in. Justice is about the restoration of relationships to what they were and could have been before these things happened. Capital punishment is not and never has been justice. We're going to kill someone who killed somebody else to prove that killing people is wrong. It's insanity. And yet we have invested ourselves in this language of things like capital punishment as justice. I want justice. It's not justice. Restorative justice says this: when you break into somebody's home and scatter all of their belongings and take the valuables, you have just violated a relationship in community. Whether I live down the street from you, whether I lived a few miles from you, it understands that human beings were designed by God to be in relationship together in community, and that if I have gone and violated your space, violated your stuff, threatened you or your family, I have violated that relationship in community. I have stressed out, even potentially severed that relationship in community, and that the goal of the work that we do in meeting out justice should be to find the pathway to restore those relationships in community. To build a system that helps to bring offender and victim together, literally sitting across the table from each other, to share the hurt that has been done, to give apologies where they are due, to make agreements around restitution, and to cut a pathway for restoration and resolution of relationships. Because the system as we have it now nurtures the dehumanization of the other. The criminal is seen as the other. The offender who broke into your home is seen as the other. It was amazing to go to a conference at Harvard not too long ago where Bruce Weston was speaking. And it was amazing for me because I had studied Bruce Weston's writings. He's written so much from a sociological academic's perspective on mass incarceration and how it developed in this country. And to hear him now, many years after most of the books that he originally wrote, that I've read, that I use in my own work, to say that what he has come to the conclusion of is that what will make the difference in us coming to the end of mass incarceration is that we have to close the empathy gap. We have to close the gap that exists where I cannot conceive of empathizing with what it was in your lived experience, in your mind, in your lifetime that led you to the door of my house to break in and take my stuff and scatter my belongings and threaten my families. I have preached many times on the story of the Good Samaritan. And for anybody who's ever heard the story of the Good Samaritan, we often talk about the different characters who passed that man by, who was beaten up by the robbers on the roadside, and talk about what was going through their heads and why they chose to pass him by and how they were failing the basic calling that Jesus was putting before them. And then we talk about how the Good Samaritan, who shouldn't have been concerned about this man, given the ethnic tensions that existed between his people and the people that this man represented, actually exemplified what Jesus is trying to show us and went and helped this man and paid for his caregiving. But I have always preached that sermon from a different perspective and asked people to consider the robbers on the roadside. Unnamed. We never hear their names, but they were robbers on the roadside who besieged this man and left him almost for dead. What was their story? What happened to them in their lives that led them to do such a dastardly thing? Why would they be comfortable with the idea of beating a man to within an inch of his life and taking him for his valuables and goods? What would make them think that that was possibly okay? We know Jesus was concerned about the robbers on the roadside because he hung on the cross with two thieves, one on either side, and declared to them, "Verily today I tell you, today you shall see me in paradise." Until we start looking at the robbers on the roadside the same way we would look at them if they were our own blood children, our own adopted children, our own family members, the empathy gap will continue to exist. In many of our communities, they are family members. They are our brothers and sisters. They are our cousins. They are that one who we grew up with down the street. My own brother served a year in state prison down south. We understand that there is no gap because we're faced right there. But for too many of those who have grown up and been invested in privilege, there is this huge gap. And the way that white supremacy works, where it sets up this theo-anthropological hierarchy, where some people are created from a more potent and superior form of dust than others are, white supremacy allows you to believe that it's all about some cultural pathology with those folks. It's all about some sort of just basic inferiority. It allows one to invest themselves in a lack of understanding the other and to then translate that lack of understanding into judging the other. Jesus teaches us, judge not lest we be judged. And so if we recognize the demon of white supremacy in our midst, then we have to recognize what it does to us. And the worst thing that it does to us is that it takes us and it splits us off. And it others us. If you don't share my experience, if you don't share my life story, my testimony, if you don't understand where I came from, if you don't understand what I went through in life, I am other to you. And society encourages you to simply cast me off as other. It's about the depth of social alienation, which you may not know. We go back to the times of Theodore Parker. Theodore Parker lived on the tail end of the generation that came to America and set up the American Republic in the late 1700s as this grand Republican with a small r experiment in governance of, by, and for the people. Back in those days, they used to do capital punishment for everything and anything. It wasn't just killing somebody. You could steal a man's horse. You could do something to a child. Whatever it might be. They would kill you for everything. And they actually dreamed up the birth of the prison and the first penitentiaries that were built up here in New England, up here in New York State, as a grand experiment, in trying something different, where people could go and could be reformed. They could work maybe in solitude, maybe in fellowship with other inmates. They would be exposed to religious edification and teaching and be prepared to go back out into the world. Benjamin Rush, one of the signers of the Declaration of Independence, a medical doctor, an ardent abolitionist. He was the one that said a execution in a democracy is like a sacrifice in religion. He understood how upside down a way that was to look at these things. Benjamin Rush in the 1700s. These are not new ideas, but what has happened is that white supremacy has moved deeper and deeper. And once our ancestors who wanted to enslave people who looked like me could no longer do that, they came up with every excuse they could to re-enslave them through the post-convict lease system, through the institutions that built the seeds for mass incarceration as we know it. Because of that amendment that ended slavery, except in the case of conviction for a felony, we have to make the shift from a system that is focused on retribution and punishment to a system centered on restoration, where we recognize that we were all designed by the same God, beautiful in God's image, as brothers and sisters, no matter how little we know of each other, no matter how little our paths have crossed, and that any time there is a violation in community, any time one person causes harm to another person, we need to stop and see what we can't do to try and repair those relationships. Some of the most powerful stories from restorative justice, because this stuff really is designed for the worst things that we do to each other. This stuff really is designed for the situations of murder, for the situations of mass murder. Some of the most powerful restorative justice stories are situations where a family has been victimized by murder, and through a course of events and a commitment to a set of theological principles, that victim's family decides to try and be in relationship with the one who has done this to their family over time, on their own time, over the years, and build relationship with them. Even to the point in some cases where mothers whose sons have been killed by this other young man choose to adopt that young man as their own son. Extraordinary. But it's real. It's possible. And our job, if we want lasting criminal justice reform, is to break that down to all of the smaller pieces. I've been victimized by crime. My family can tell you of the day that we came back to our house after going out to dinner, and I had just taken off my sneakers and began to hear the alarm in our car starting to beep and blare, and stuck my head out the door, and there's this young guy digging in all of our stuff in the car, and I was mad as hell, and I went busting out of there in my slippers, and the only thing that stopped me from chasing him down and grabbing him was that I had my slippers on, and he ran into a dark field, and I didn't want to tear up my feet. Crime makes us angry. Harm is a negative thing in the human experience. We have to account for that. We have to recognize that. We have to come face to face with that because it's real and it's true. It's a young couple of boys one time who stole my daughter's bike. We were living in Chicago. And the foolish thing was they thought they could ride that bike around the neighborhood and nobody would notice.
few days later, I was over at work, and my wife called me up and said, "I just saw the boys on that bike." She went and chased them down. Called the police, because they were trying to run into the backyards of other people's homes. And I got over there, and we stood there. And I struggled standing there in that moment. Because I said, trying to send these boys to jail isn't going to do anything to help them understand the real wrong of what they've done. Because if any of these boys had just asked us for that bike, we probably would have given it to them and bought another one. We have to struggle in these moments to recognize that the system as it's built right now is upside down. It warehouses human beings in the name of making the community safe. It does not invest in rehabilitation. It does not invest out of a theology of restoration. It does not open up an easy space for religious organizations and communities to come in and teach the kind of values that will actually help people to function better in society. It does none of those things. It warehouses them. It uses them for cheap, almost $0 labor in many cases. And it uses them to help advance the careers of attorneys generals, of politicians who are seeking to provide jobs in rural communities where the industry left. This is what has been going on. And it's only possible because we see those people as disposable. Right? The reason why Congressman Charlie Rangel, for so many years, out of a district in Harlem, has been trying to bring the draft back into this country is not because he didn't learn the lessons. Hello, sweetheart. Not because he didn't learn the lessons of Vietnam, but because he's always believed that if these senators and congressmen had to face the possibility that their son or daughter might be going off to that war that they were voting to go ahead and authorize, they might hesitate for a moment and invest themselves more in diplomacy and peace. Diplomacy and peace, what Jimmy Carter did, what President Barack Obama has tried to do and been pilloried for it. So we have to understand that restorative justice is the means by which we turn the upside down, right side up, the way by which we build a system in our schools, where we have the schools-to-prison pipeline, in our juvenile detention centers, where we start putting people on that direct track, and in our prisons, and in our courts, and in our justice systems, and before they ever even get in front of a judge, we have to begin to invest ourselves in restorative justice. There are bills trying to advance restorative justice right now in the Massachusetts legislature. They've been experimenting with this in other states around the country. Mark Umbright's been writing about this for years. Howard Zia's been writing about this for years. This is nothing new. African indigenous communities have been practicing restorative practices and circle processes for centuries and centuries. The same thing with American Indian communities. This is nothing new, but this is something that is new because it comes against white supremacy that has punctured these cups and turned them upside down and tried to tell us that everything was normal and you could drink out of these cups right now. We have to recognize that each and every one of us has the capacity for the positive exercise of freedom. We have to invest ourselves in a theological assumption that we were designed to be free, autonomous individuals pursuing the divine design for our life. And what I mean is that when God created us with free will. And if God had not created us with free will, what happened in the Garden of Eden would have been impossible, because Eve wouldn't have had the option to choose to eat that apple or not to choose to eat that apple. We would have simply been puppets of our Lord. But instead, we were designed to be free. We were designed to have the freedom to make those choices. And when I speak of the positive exercise the capacity for the positive exercise of freedom, I mean that each and every one of us can make the right choices, choices that honor the simple and essential biblical wisdom that we ought to love our neighbor as we love ourselves, that we ought to have a real opportunity at the chance of a full and rich life characterized by prosperity and abundance, that each and every one of us was designed with a purpose in mind and a divinely ordained plan to fulfill, that none of us were designed to spend the better part of our lives in cages made by the hands of men and women behind prison bars. None of us. None of us. And so once we understand that we have a demon of white supremacy to exercise from all the institutions and agencies, and then once we recognize that we must confront it with the alternative of restorative justice based on the theological assumptions that are expressed by restorative justice, then the third piece, as I come to my conclusion, because I'm sure I'm about to go over my time, is that we must be sure that we are committed for the long haul and what you've heard Barack Obama and others call the permanent campaign. And what I talk about in terms of a permanent campaign is that when we think of campaigns, we think of the movements that are built to make changes in our society. I listen all the time to sermons by Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., who pours into my spirit this understanding of prophetic witness. And the campaign to desegregate the buses in Montgomery, Alabama, was a campaign. It was a boycott. It went on for days and days and days and days. They did not take the buses to prove the point. If you want us on your buses, if you want us spending our money on your buses, you need to treat us equal. It was a campaign. And it took people working hard. It took people being willing to let folks they might or might not know into their cars and to carpool people and to choose not to hop on that bus over and over and over again, to risk being late to work, to come together before cell phones, before emails and text messages, to keep on posting those posters and billboards all around the neighborhood, to go back and forth with the powers that be in Montgomery. They carried it on for a matter of months. And I am talking about the fact that we must have the mindset to carry on that kind of campaign activity permanently. Permanently. Recognize that before it was Christianity, what Jesus started with those 12 disciples was a movement. It was a campaign for the kingdom of God. And at its best, the Christianity that Theodore Parker was invested in understood that it was a permanent movement to turn the world upside down. Exercising the sort of demons that we are talking about, it's not the work for the faint of heart. It's not for the thin of skin. It's not for those who expect crops without plowing up the ground, as Frederick Douglass said. It has taken centuries to embed these ideas and these practices into our culture, into our unconscious, and into our legal apparatus. And it will take centuries to uproot it all too, because we have to get down to the roots. We may be able to end mass incarceration in our lifetime. Statistics tell us that it has already plateaued and begun to decline, praise the Lord. But the collateral consequences will take much longer to adequately address. The families who have suffered from the fathers and mothers being out of the home will take a generation or two to heal from that wound. I stood on the other side of a jail cell from a black man one day who explained to me that he was locked up, his father was locked up, and the grandfather was locked up. Three generations of men locked behind bars. What do you think that does to a community? What do you think that does to a whole generation of families? The communities and the generations that have had this happen, it will take a generation or two to heal from that wound. The communities that have lost whole sectors of their population will have to grow accustomed to hundreds, thousands, tens of thousands walking around with a scarlet A hidden just beneath their overcoat. Politicians and elected officials will have to accept the reality that undoing the wrongs of the past 40 years will require decades of legislation, decades of debates, decades of political platitudes and apologies. apologies and appeals to fix a broken system. Grassroots organizations like the one that I serve, the Boston Workers Alliance, and EPICA, Ex-Prisoners and Prisoners Advancing for the Community, and so many others will have to fight through the complexities of the so-called nonprofit industrial complex and hunker down for the long haul to truly fulfill their mission. And the allies in the faith communities, in the sectors of society where white privilege is the norm, where people are used to it. You must be prepared to stand for justice now and to teach your children and your children's children to do the same. To do the same. The reason why it is so important to understand this work as that of exercising demons and shifting from retribution to restoration is because it gives us a sense of vision for the work that lies ahead. And if we do not have a sense of vision, we are not going to make it. It provides us with a set of principles to guide us. It sets a north star on our horizon and challenges us to walk forward towards it with a sense of steadfast and unwavering commitment. We are in this unique moment now, as I said earlier, where politicians and elected officials feel obliged to talk about criminal justice reform the way they used to talk about health care reform, and to talk of bipartisan solutions to this problem, and to go before the NAACP to appeal for a level of forgiveness like former President Bill Clinton did, because he was single-handedly responsible for helping to advance mass incarceration to a level we had never seen before. There is an opportunity that we have to influence this national conversation in order to make sure that this vision is not neglected or ignored. But we also, and with this I will close in these next few minutes, we also must be on guard against reactionary forces in the body politic. We must be on guard against law enforcement agencies and their representatives who seek to portray Black Lives Matter as propelling an anti-cop agenda. Those who seek to blame the recent rise on crime that some cities are witnessing on the uprisings and movements against racist police violence that have emerged. If we understand the nature of demonic possession, we must be ready to translate that in secular terms to help everyone understand that our movement is a movement to change broken systems and not to condemn or demonize people in uniform. To say that Black Lives Matter is not to say that it's okay to disrespect, mistreat, or God forbid, go out and kill cops. It is to say that when a school resource officer comes into a classroom and takes a difficult Black child that looks like either one of my daughters and is comfortable, is normalized, the idea that he can pick her up and throw her across a classroom, that is saying to all of us, Black lives don't matter. And you have been enculturated and taught that it's okay because you would never do that to a white child. That's what it means. You would never even think to do that to a white child. Never. The demons have the man. The demons have the man. Fighting against racist police violence is about uprooting and exercising the demon from our systems of criminal justice. A lot of good men and women go into law enforcement. They go into departments where police officers are referred to, get this, as peace officers. Imagine if that officer had gone into that classroom and tried to make peace with that girl. I've got adolescent girls. They have attitudes sometimes. But I thank the Lord that wasn't my daughter he was throwing across that room, because I'd be speaking to you live from a prison cell right now. The reality is that even people with the best of intentions are sucked into a system that is designed to make them fail. The Bible teaches that blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called sons and daughters of God. The work of making peace is holy and sacred work because it affirms the fundamental equal humanity of everyone involved and says that we must try to be in relationship with one another in such a way that is not violent but is peaceful. Yitzhak Rabin tried to bring peace in the Middle East, and he was assassinated for it. And now we have these dodo heads like Bibi Netanyahu running around and trying to stoke all of this mess. The Holy Land, peace has eluded us for hundreds of years. The land where Jesus uttered those words, blessed are the peacemakers. We need to rebuild our law enforcement agencies to be built around a culture of making peace, where peace officers are called upon to de-escalate situations, not to escalate them. They're trained to de-escalate situations. The culture that surrounds them and supports them builds their skills to de-escalate situations. They go and take the classes that social workers take, and they go and learn pastoral care like pastors take, and they learn to be peacemakers. So that one day I can actually be comfortable telling my children, if something is wrong, go find the nearest police officer. Right now, I'm not so sure. And it's not because the man has demons, but because the demons have the man. The work that lies ahead of us is not easy work. It's work that will force some of us to confront some things we don't want to confront. It is work that will require us to dig into the long haul, dig in for the long haul, and to moderate our expectations. Reinhold Niebuhr taught us the wisdom of this, about how quickly it will happen. But we have to be committed to it. When Reverend Clementa Pinckney and all of those down there at Mother Emanuel AME Church in Charleston were massacred, it reminded every pastor and preacher that you have to be ready to die at any point, like the apostle Stephen, because just going to teach Bible study is an event that takes your life into your hands. But if we don't have the mindset that we know what we're ready to die for, we will not be fit to live. Because it's only once you know what you're ready to die for that you're empowered and prepared to live for it all the days of your life. So I encourage each and every one here to have the conversations with their souls, as I said last week, Lord. To have the conversations with your souls. To ask yourself, what am I ready to die for? And to commit to that so that you'll be fit to live. God bless you.